No one dared to look up. With measured steps the Dalai Lama began his solemn circuit of the parka. From time to time he stopped before the figures of Buddha and gazed at them. He was followed by a brilliant retinue of all the high dignitaries and nobles. After them followed the officials in order of precedence. In the procession we recognized our friends Arong, who followed close behind the Dalai Lama. Like all the nobles, he carried in his hand a smoldering stick of incense. The awed crowd kept silent. Only the music of the monks could be heard, the oboes, tubas, kettle drums, and chinals. It was like a vision of another world, a strangely unreal happening. In the yellow light of the nickering lamps, the great figures of molded butter seemed to come to life. We fancied we saw strange flowers tossing their heads in the breeze and heard the rustling of the robes of gods. The faces of these portentous figures were distorted in a demonic grimace. Then the god king raised his hand in blessing. Now the living Buddha was approaching. He passed quite close to our window. The women stiffened in a deep obeisance and hardly dared to breathe. The crowd was frozen. Deeply moved, we hid ourselves behind the women as if to protect ourselves from being drawn into the magic circle of this power. We kept saying to ourselves, "It is only a child." A child, indeed, but the heart of the concentrated faith of thousands, the essence of their prayers, longings, hopes. Whether it is Lhasa or Om, all are united by one wish, to find God and to serve Him. I closed my eyes and hearkened to the murmured prayers and the solemn music and sweet incense rising to the evening sky. Soon the Dalai Lama had completed his tour around the parka and vanished into the Tughlaq Khan. The soldiers marched away to the music of their bands. As if awakened from a hypnotic sleep, the tens of thousands of spectators passed from order into chaos. The transition was overwhelmingly sudden. The crowds broke into shouts and wild gesticulation. A moment ago they were weeping and praying or sunk in ecstatic meditation, and now they are a throng of madmen. The monk guards begin to function. They are huge fellows with padded shoulders and blackened faces to make them more terrible. They lay about them with their whips, but the crowds press frantically around the statues of Buddha, which are now in danger of being overturned. Even those who have been bludgeoned come back into the fray. One would think they were possessed by demons. Are they really the same people who just now were bowing humbly before a child? The next morning the streets were empty. The Buddha figures had been carried away, and no trace remained of the reverence or the ecstasy of the night before. Market stalls had taken the place of the stands that had carried the statues. The brightly colored figures of the saints had melted and would be used as fuel for lamps, or would be made up into magic medicines. Asylum granted. Many people came to visit us. Tibetans journeyed from far and wide to Lhasa to attend the New Year festival, among them people whom we had got to know on our journey. It was not hard for them to find us, as we were still much talked of, and every child knew where we lived. Some brought us presents of dried meat, which is much appreciated in Lhasa. We learned, moreover, from these people that the officials through whose districts we had passed had been severely censured by the government. It depressed us to feel that persons who had received us in such a friendly manner had suffered such unpleasantness on our account. But it seemed that they bore us no grudge. We met a Bonpo whom we had bamboozled with our old travel permit, and he only laughed and seemed glad to see us again. The New Year's celebrations did not pass off this year without a mishap. An accident that attracted much attention occurred on the parka. Every year they put up high flagstaffs made of heavy tree trunks fitted into one another. These are brought from distant places, and it is quite a task to carry them to Lhasa. It is managed in a very primitive way, and my indignation was aroused when I saw, for the first time, a procession coming in. It reminded me of the Volga boatmen. About 20 men drag each trunk, which is attached to them by a rope round their waists. They sing a monotonous air as they trudge along, keeping step with one another. They sweat and pant, but their foreman, who leads the singing, gives them no pause for rest. This forced labor is in part a substitute for taxation. The carriers are picked up at villages on the road and dismissed when they come to the next settlement. The monotonous airs to which they drag their burden are said to distract their minds from the severity of their task. I should have thought they would do better to save their breath. The sort of fatalistic resignation with which they lent themselves to this back-breaking toil always used to infuriate me. As a product of our modern age, I could not understand why the people of Tibet were so rigidly opposed to any form of progress. There obviously must be some better means of transporting these heavy burdens than by manhandling them. The Chinese invented and used the wheel thousands of years ago, but the Tibetans will have none of it, though its use would give an immense impulse to transport and commerce, and would raise the whole standard of living throughout the country. When, later, I was engaged in irrigation works, I made various finds that strengthened my belief that the Tibetans had known and used the wheel many centuries ago. We uncovered hundreds of great blocks of stones as big as wardrobes. These could not have been carried save by mechanical means from the remote quarries where they had been hewn. When my workmen wanted to carry such a block from one place to another, they had first to hew it into 8 pieces. I became more and more convinced that Tibet's great days belonged to the past. There is a stone obelisk dating from year 763, that bears witness to my theory. It records the fact that in that year the Tibetan armies marched to the gates of the Chinese capital and there dictated to the Chinese terms of peace, which included an annual tribute of 50,000 bales of silk. And then there is the Potala Palace, which must date from Tibet's days of greatness. No one today would think of erecting such a building. I once asked a stonemason who was working for me why such buildings were no longer put up. He answered indignantly that the Potala was the handiwork of the gods. Men never could have achieved anything like it. Good spirits and supernatural beings had worked by night on this wonderful building. I found in this view another instance of the indifference to progress and ambition that characterized the attitude of the men who dragged the tree trunks. To return to my story. When the tree trunks are brought into Lhasa, they are bound together with strips of yak's hide to form a thick mast nearly 70 feet high. Then a huge flag bearing printed prayers and extending from the top to the bottom of the pole is nailed onto it. On this occasion the trunks were probably too heavy for the yak skin straps, for the whole mast broke into its component parts, which crushed 3 watchers to death and injured several others. The whole of Tibet took this for an evil omen, and people prophesied a black future for the country. Catastrophes such as earthquakes and floods were foretold. Men spoke of war and looked meaningly towards China. Everyone, even those who had had an English education, was a prey to superstition. Nevertheless, they did not carry the men wounded in this accident to their lamas, but to the British legation, where there was a hospital with a number of beds for Tibetans. The English doctor had plenty of work. Every morning there was a queue of clients waiting before his door, and in the afternoon he visited his patients in the town. The monks tolerated in silence this intrusion into their territory. They could hardly do otherwise, because it was impossible to ignore the doctor's success. The policy of the government toward medicine is a dark chapter in the history of modern Tibet. The doctors of the British legations were the only qualified medical men in a population of 3.5 million. Doctors would find a rich field of activity in Tibet, but the government would never consent to allow foreigners to practice. The whole power was in the hands of the monks, who criticized even government officials when they called in the English doctor. It was a hopeful omen for our future when Orf Sneta was summoned by a high monastic official and commissioned to build an irrigation canal. We were speechless with joy. This was our first step toward a settled existence in Lhasa, and it was the monks who had put us on the road. Orf Sneta began at once to work on his measurements. I wanted to help him as he had no trained assistant, so I walked out to his workplace on the Linka. An indescribable scene awaited us. The squatted hundreds, nay thousands, of monks wearing their red cowls and busy doing something for which privacy is generally regarded as essential. I did not envy Orf Sneta his place of work. We went obstinately on with our job, looking neither to the right nor to the left, but vowed to ourselves to move as soon as possible from the neighborhood. Ofsnatum made good headway and in a fortnight was ready to start digging. 150 workers were placed at his disposal, and we began to feel that we were important contractors. But we had yet to learn the methods of work practiced in this country. In the meantime, I had also found a job myself. I was still an invalid, and Zarong's garden was the best place for a man in my condition, but I kept wondering what I could do to make it more beautiful. Then I had an inspiration. I would make a fountain. I took measurements and made drawings and soon had prepared a beautiful plan. Zarong was enthusiastic. He chose the servants who were to help me, and I sat comfortably in the sunshine and directed my gang. Underground pipes were soon laid and a pool dug. Zarong insisted on taking a hand personally in the cementing. Since the erection of the famous iron bridge, he had been an authority on reinforced concrete. Then we had to build a cistern on the roof of the house to supply the fountain with water. It was pretty hard work pumping the water up into the cistern, but I made a virtue of necessity and used the hand pump for training my muscles. At last the great moment arrived, and for the first time a jet of water, as high as the house, sprang from my fountain. We were all as happy as children. This was the only fountain in Tibet, and from now on it was the piece de resistance at Zarong's garden parties. New impressions and an unwonted activity almost made us forget our cares. One day Thang brought us a newspaper in Tibetan and showed us an article about ourselves, which related in a very friendly spirit how we had burst our way through the mountain barriers and reached Lhasa, and how we were now begging for the protection of this pious, neutral country. We thought that these friendly lines could have a favorable influence on public opinion and hoped they might lend some support to our petition. It is true that the journal in question would have been of little account in Europe. It appeared once a month and was published at Kalimpong, in India. Its circulation did not exceed 500 copies, but it was read rather extensively in Lhasa in certain circles, and individual numbers were sent to Tibetologues throughout the world. The New Year celebrations were not yet at an end, though the most important ceremonies had been performed. Now came the athletic gathering on the parker in front of the Tsuglag Kang. As an old athlete, I was particularly interested, and every day at sunrise found me at the games, which started early in the morning. We had been lucky enough to secure places at a window on the second floor of the Chinese legation, from which we watched, well concealed behind a curtain. That was our only way of getting around the order forbidding anyone to sit above the ground floor in the presence of the regent, who sat, enthroned behind a muslin curtain, on the first floor of the Tsuglag Kang. The four cabinet ministers watched through the windows. The first events were wrestling bouts. I could not make up my mind whether the wrestlers' methods were more like the Greco-Roman or the catcher's catchkin style. They obviously had their own rules. Here a fall is given when any part of the body except the feet touches the ground. There are no lists of competitors nor any preliminary announcements. A felt mat is spread out, and men come out of the crowd and take each other on. The combatants wear only a loincloth and shiver in the cold morning air. They are all well-grown, muscular fellows. They jig around with wild gestures under the noses of their opponents and assume an air of swaggering courage. But they have no notion of the art of wrestling and would be easily vanquished by a real wrestler. The bouts are soon over, and a new pair comes on the scene. One never seems to see a keen struggle for victory. Winners get no special distinction, but winners and losers both receive white scarves. They bow to the Bonpo, who hands them the scarves with a benevolent smile, and prostrate themselves three times in honor of the regent, after which they rejoin the crowd the best of friends. Next came a weight-lifting competition. The weight is a heavy, smooth stone, which must have seen hundreds of New Year festivals. It has to be lifted and carried around the flagstaff. Very few people can perform this feat. There is much laughter when a competitor swaggers up to the stone with an air of overweening confidence and then finds that he can hardly lift it off the ground, or when it slips out of his hands, threatening to squash his toes in its fall. Then suddenly one hears the far-off thud of galloping horses. weightlifting comes to an end. The horse races are starting. Here come the beasts in a thick cloud of dust. In these races there is no staked-out course. The riderless horses take their own line, often through the crowd, whom the monk soldiers have been trying to drive out of the way with their cudgels. These races, like some of the other events, are hard to understand. The unridden beasts start off in a mass some miles outside the town and burst through the excited public, who unwillingly withdraw to the side of the track in order to let them go by on their way to the winning post. Only horses bred in Tibet are allowed to enter, and each horse carries the owner's name on a cloth on his back. There is keen competition between the stables, but when the Dalai Lama or a minister has a horse running, it is obvious that he has got to come in first. When it looks as if an outsider is likely to beat an official horse, grooms run out and stop him before he gets to the post. The races are followed with tremendous excitement. The crowd and the servants of owners howl and cry to encourage the runners, while the noble lords who own the animals try to look dignified. The whole field storms madly past toward the winning post, which lies a little way to the back of the town. The cloud of dust kicked up by the hoofs of the horses had scarcely time to settle before the first of the footrunners came panting up. And what a rabble they were! Anyone can take part in a foot race, from old men to small boys. Here they come, with bleeding, blistered feet, out of breath and with distorted faces. One can see that they have never been in training in their lives. Many drop out long before completing the 5-mile course, having gained nothing by their efforts except the laughter of the bystanders. The last of the runners are still limping in when the next event is started. This time it is a mounted race with the riders wearing historic costumes. They are greeted with cries of enthusiasm and use their whips wildly to get the last ounce out of their beasts. The crowd wave their arms and shout, a horse bucks and his rider flies in an arc into the midst of the spectators. Nobody minds. This is the last athletic event of the meeting, and afterward the prize winners come forward, each carrying a wooden square showing in what order he reached the post. There are about 100 runners and almost the same number of riders in the two events. They receive colored or white scarves from the judges, but there is no applause from the spectators. To close the proceedings, a gymkhana is held in a huge field outside Lhasa. We hurried along with the crowd and were very glad to be invited by one of the nobles into his tent. These festival tents offer a wonderful picture. They are pitched in serried ranks, and each is furnished in a manner corresponding to the station of its owner. Many of them are draped with silks and brocades and decorated with gorgeous ornaments. Add to them the rich robes of the men and women, and you have a real symphony in color. Civil officials of the fourth rank and upward wear glossy yellow silk robes with large plate-shaped hats with brims of blue fox fur. These furs come from Hamburg. Tibetans find their own foxes are not good enough. Competition in smartness of dress is not confined to the women. The men take their part. Their Asiatic love of finery puts them in contact with many parts of the world. Thus blue foxes come from Hamburg, cultured pearls from Japan, turquoise from Persia via Bombay, corals from Italy, and amber from Berlin and Königsberg. I have often written letters for rich noblemen to addresses all over the world ordering they saw that article deluxe. Pomp and decoration are here a necessity. They have to be displayed to advantage in clothes and furnishings. The common people enjoy no luxury themselves but appreciate it in their betters. The great festivals are really an occasion for displaying pomp and power, and the high dignitaries know that they owe it to the people to make a good show. When, on the last day of the feast, the four cabinet ministers exchange their costly headdresses for the red fringed hats of their servants in order to show for a moment their equality with the people, the enthusiasm and admiration of the public know no bounds. The gymkhana, or horse show, is the most popular of all spectacles. It is probably a survival of former great military parades. In the past the feudal lords had at certain times to march their troops past their overlord and thus show their readiness for war, but this significance has long disappeared. Nevertheless, there are many features of these games that recall the warlike days of Mongol influence, when marvelous feats of horsemanship were the order of the day. We had occasion to admire some incredibly skillful performances by Tibetan horsemen. Every noble family enters a certain number of participants for these games, and, of course, there is the utmost keenness to choose the best men so that the team may do well in the final classification. Competitors have to show off their skill in riding and shooting. When I saw what they could do, I simply could not get over it. They stood upright in the saddle and while their horses were galloping past a hanging target, swung up their matchlocks and shot into the bull's eye. Before they had reached the next target, 20 yards away, they had exchanged their muskets for bows and arrows. Shouts of joy acclaimed the mounted archer who hit the mark. It is incredible how adroit the Tibetans are at changing from one weapon to another. At these festivities, the Tibetan government displays typical hospitality, even toward foreigners. Splendid tents of honor are put up for all the foreign legations, and servants and liaison officers see to it that the guests have everything they want. I noticed an unusual number of Chinese on the sports ground. They are easily distinguishable from the Tibetans, though they belong to the same racial family. The Tibetans are not markedly slit-eyed, they have pleasant, refined faces and red cheeks. The rich Chinese costumes of the past have in many cases given way to European suits, and many Chinese, in this respect more progressive than the Tibetans, wear spectacles. Most of the Chinese in Lhasa are merchants who maintain prosperous trade relations with their own country. They enjoy living in Tibet, and many settle down permanently in Lhasa. One reason for this is that most Chinese are passionate opium smokers, and there is no explicit prohibition of opium smoking in Tibet. Sometimes a Tibetan, seduced by the example of the Chinese, takes to the opium pipe. If he does, he is likely to be punished. There is no danger that opium smoking may become a national vice. The vigilance of the authorities is far too keen. They already consider tobacco smoking to be a vice and control it very closely and, though one can buy any sort of cigarette in Lhasa, there is no smoking in offices, in the streets, or at public ceremonies. When the monks take control in the Fire Hound year, they even forbid the sale of cigarettes. That is why all Tibetans are snuff takers. The laity and the monks use their own preparation of snuff, which they find stimulating. Everyone is proud of his own mixture, and when two Tibetans meet, the first thing they do is to take out their snuff boxes and exchange a pinch of snuff. Snuff boxes, too, are a subject for pride. One finds them in all materials from yak horn to jade. The hardened snuff taker spreads his dose on his thumbnail, sniffs it up, and then blows a cloud of dust out of his mouth, and never dreams of sneezing. If anyone burst out into a fearful sneeze, it was always I, and the company never failed to laugh. There are also Nepalese in Lhasa, richly clad and stout of body. One can see, even at a distance, that they are prosperous. By virtue of an old treaty, they are exempt from taxation, and they have the means to exploit this favored situation thoroughly. The finest businesses in the Parka belong to them. They are expert dealers, with a sixth sense for a good bargain. Most of them leave their families at home and go back to them from time to time, unlike the Chinese, who are apartment to marry Tibetan women, to whom they make model husbands. At official festivities, the representatives of Nepal outdo even the gaily clad Tibetans in brilliance of dress, and the red tunics of the Gurkhas, who form their bodyguard, are conspicuous from afar. These Gurkhas have acquired a certain reputation in Lhasa. They alone venture to contravene the prohibition against fishing. When the government hears of such breaches of the law, it sends a solemn protest to the Nepalese legation. This gives rise to a nice little comedy. The guilty persons must, of course, be punished, as the legation sets much store on good relations with the Tibetan government. But as a matter of fact, more important persons than mere soldiers are often involved. Indeed, many high-class Tibetans enjoy a plate of fish when they can get it. The poor culprits receive a terrible reprimand and are sentenced to be whipped, but the chastisement is not meant to hurt. No one would dare to go fishing in Lhasa, In the whole of Tibet there is only one place where fishing is allowed, and that is where the Tsangpo River runs through a sandy desert. Here there are no crops and no pasture for animals. In fact, there is nothing to eat but fish, and so the law has been relaxed. The people of this region are looked down upon, like the slaughterers and blacksmiths. In point of numbers, the Muslims form an appreciable part of the population of Lhasa. They have a mosque of their own and enjoy full freedom to practice their religion. One of the best characteristics of the Tibetan people is their complete tolerance of other creeds. Their monastic theocracy has never sought the conversion of infidels. Most of the Muslims have immigrated from India and have intermingled with the Tibetans. Their religious zeal led them at first to demand that their Tibetan wives should be converted. But here the Tibetan government stepped in and made it a condition that native women could marry Muslims only if they kept to their own faith. At the Gymkhana it is possible to pick out examples of all the population groups. One sees Ladakhis, Bhutanese, Mongolians, Sikkimese, Kazakhs, and representatives of all the neighboring tribes, among whom one finds Huihuis, Chinese Muslims from the province of Kukunor. These people own the slaughterhouses situated in a special quarter outside the Linka. Buddhists look askance at them because they take the life of animals, but they are allowed to have their own place of worship. At the end of the festival, the nobles and notables march back to the town in a glittering procession. The common people stand by the roadside and admire the splendor of their demigods. They have had their fill of excitement and drama, and the faithful will feast for long on the memory of these tremendous ceremonies at which the god king showed himself to them. Workaday life begins again. Shops are opened, and bargains driven as keenly as ever. Dice players appear at street corners, and the dogs, who during the Lenten fast have migrated to the outskirts of the Linka, come back to the town. Our life continued peacefully. Summer approached, my sciatica got better, and nothing was said about our expulsion. I was receiving regular treatment from the English doctor, but on fine days I was able to work in the garden. And I had a lot to do, for when it was known that I was responsible for Zarong's fountain and various other rearrangements in his grounds, notables came, one after another, and asked me to do the same for them. Orf Snater was very busy making his canal. From early morning till evening, he was at his workplace, for work stopped only on feast days. It was a fortunate thing that he had been employed by their monks, for though the lay nobles play an important part in the administration of the country, a small group of monks has the last word in everything. For this reason I felt no little satisfaction when one day I was summoned to the garden of the Tsedrung. The monks of this foundation are officials who form a sort of monastic order. Brought up to be strictly loyal to their own community, they have become far more powerful than the secular officials. They provide the immediate entourage of the Dalai Lama, and all the personal servants of the young god king belong to this order. His chamberlains, his tutor, and his personal guardians are all Tsedrung monks of high standing. Moreover, the Dalai Lama attends the meetings which they are obliged to hold daily, to discuss the interests of their community. The officials of this order are, without exception, strictly trained. Their school is situated in the east wing of the Pukla, and their teachers come, according to tradition, from the famous cloister of Mondroling, which specializes in Tibetan calligraphy and grammar. Anybody can enter the school, but adoption into the order is very difficult. A rule dating from many centuries prescribes that the members of the Tsedrung shall not exceed 175. When the student has reached his 18th year and has passed his examinations, he can enter the order with powerful patronage. Beginning at the bottom, he may, if sufficiently capable, attain to the third class in the order. Monks of the Tsedrung wear, in addition to the usual red cowls, garments distinctive of their rank. Most of the students in the Tsedrung school come from the people, and they provide a useful counterpoise to the influence of the hereditary nobles. They have a wide field of activity, as there are no government offices in which there is not at least one monastic official to every layman. This system of dual control is considered an insurance against the exercise of dictatorial power, which is one of the standing dangers of feudalism. It was the High Chamberlain who had sent for me. He proposed that I should rearrange the garden of the Tse Drung. That was a great chance for me.